Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. My name is Tracy Morgan, your host, and today we'll be speaking with Dr. Jameson Webster about her new publication, her new book, The Life and Death of Psychoanalysis, published by Carnac, 2011. Dr. Webster is affiliated with three very interesting and not always related institutes, actually. She's affiliated with the New York Psychoanalytic Institute, which is this year celebrating its 100th anniversary. She's also affiliated with the Institute for Psychoanalytic Training and Research, and as well as with the Lacanian Institute here in New York, Après Coup. She is widely and well and deeply informed in things Lacanian, and has set her sights on thinking about what's happening. Why is psychoanalysis often and repeatedly being declared on the verge of death? And what is at stake with its life and its death? But this is not just a book that's about the profession per se, although it asks very important questions of the profession. It's also a book in which we experience the nexus of philosophy vis-a-vis Adorno and Badiou and psychoanalytic thinking. She asks us questions about why we seek knowledge and what we think knowledge and having knowledge as analysts will do for us. She pursues ethics, writing, psychoanalytic writing, psychoanalytic training, mourning, and of course, desire. She suggests that, and I'm going to quote her here, to declare that the unconscious exists without righteousness or justification is an inherently weak position that we must bear out if our discipline is to have any effect on truth. So we're looking forward to a delightful interview. And without further ado, let's get to it.
So Jameson, I have enjoyed your book. It's been very thought-provoking. I wanted to say two things in beginning the interview. One is that as I read this book, I began to dream profoundly, much more so. Somehow my dream life went through the roof. And I think that the text stirred something in my unconscious. I mean, at times I hated the book. It made me feel stupid. And I don't like to feel stupid, but it also prompted me to reckon with how little I know and how unimportant I think, as you stress again and again, knowing or knowledge in the end is in our work as analysts. Understanding is not important. My deceased analyst, Phyllis Meadow, used to say to me all the time, don't bother with understanding. What's the point of that? So I wanted to begin with a quote of yours, which is, you write, knowledge is drained of eros in order to pledge a future that belongs to no one. Psychoanalysis was always a hollowed out promise, mere words which cannot sustain themselves without submitting to this passion for being, passion always being something precarious. So I wanted to ask you, to kick off our interview, what prompted you to write this book?
Lord, what prompted me to write this book? You know that it's an iteration of my dissertation, but one that was sort of radically rewritten, I think, after the time that I finally got out of graduate school. And the question of knowledge, just in relationship to that, is interesting. I just felt myself sort of balking against the project of writing a dissertation, or the very idea that what a dissertation is supposed to be, in the way that that also sort of fitted with the question of training, psychoanalytic training, mm-hmm. that what you're supposed to do is demonstrate your knowledge. It's as if I couldn't do this. I literally couldn't do it. And I had to find another way to write, and I had to find another way to speak about what it is that was important to me during that time. And my good fortune was that I found people who were with me on this project and who understood that as being a really interesting question to ask about psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And my psychoanalytic training, or the period in which I sort of see as the most formative period of my psychoanalytic training or formation, if you want to put it that way, was also at the time that I was in graduate school. So it felt to me as if these two things were colliding. Lacan talks about the fact that, you know, what you're undergoing when you're undergoing your own personal analysis and you're trying to ask these questions about what it means to listen as an analyst at the exact same time, sometimes means that you need to speak about it or you need to write about it.
Right.
And I think that the way in which he heard that, probably in his patients and in his students, and the way in which I felt that as well, sort of engendered the project that is strangely this book at the end of everything.
Right.
You're not the first person who's told me that whatever it is that takes place in this book allows them to dream. I'd be hard pressed to say that I have any idea of what that is, except for the fact that maybe an encounter with another person's desire sparks your own.
I think that makes a lot of sense, because the book opens up, it doesn't close anything. It actually opens up a tremendous amount, and really got me sort of uncomfortable and uneasy in a way that I felt was truly was generative. As you looked at, you know, sort of analytic training and actually asking the question, should, you know, what would it mean for psychoanalysis to die, given that this title? I wanted to ask you, of course, the title, I guess, references Laplanche, Life and Death in Psychoanalysis. I thought about Norman O'Brown. I was like, God, there's a lot. This title has a lot of resonance. Talk to us about the title, because I think people will find it very. It makes a lot of sort of quick and unconscious sense to those of us in the profession. But could you say more about your choice of the title?
It's, you know, there's been this funny reaction, which is like, how can you write a book with a title like that? It's so, it's so big, you know, it's so grandiose.
Yeah.
It's funny because when I think about it, it was just sort of this natural title, because it's a play on one of the dreams in the book, mm-hmm. right? The dream where I find this letter of my grandmother telling me that Laplanche's book, Life and Death, Psychoanalysis, would come to be a very important text. And so when you realize that it's just a play on a signifier from a dream, that it's sort of a sliding into a whole series of meanings, it can't be grandiose. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe to take down a little bit the question of what it means to sort of devote your life to psychoanalysis, into the place where it has to make sense only through this sort of circulation of meanings. Mm-hmm. If it's Norman O'Brown, if it's Laplanche, if it's just the fact that we keep talking about Eros and the death drive again and again and again. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, now we hear so much about the death of psychoanalysis, right? I mean, if everyone wants to proclaim that it's dead, or they want to say that it's still living, and to try and force us to ask a question about what it means when, you know, we're feeling uneasy in our profession, or the resistance to the profession in general, which is always there by virtue of the quote that you read, that desire is precarious. And this is what we do.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I think that, every August, you know, patients come in and they say, oh, New York Magazine just wrote another article about how, you know, pointless psychoanalysis is, how it doesn't work, how there's no studies that show that it does anything. And I guess I wanted to get you to talk about that, because you really embrace, my sense is you embrace that position. What is psychoanalysis supposed to, quote, do anyway? Yeah. So, you know, are we there to make, are we there to help, what is psychoanalysis to be doing, and the pressure that analysts feel now, given that our profession is often deemed useless and pointless, and you seem to embrace the useless, pointless aspect, if I understand you. Is that right?
Yeah, I love this. I mean, this was something I had written into the book afterwards, but this quote by Jacques Derrida that's in the preface, where he says about Freud in his article To Speculate on Freud, how can an autobiographical writing in the abyss of an unterminated self-analysis give to a worldwide institution its birth? It's such an amazing quotation. And he doesn't, and what is so amazing to hear is that he doesn't mean this in any negative sense at all. Mm-hmm. This is what psychoanalysis makes possible. Some strange act of looking at yourself can create a worldwide institution. It can create 1,000 analysts that follow in line from this one act of sort of crossing a certain threshold.
Right.
And to believe that what we have to do is answer the calls of the day to justify ourselves, I think, is the wrong position to take. You know, explain to me what it is that you do. Justify your profession, you know, tell me what your cure is. I think that we cannot, we can't give in to this demand. And they were always there.
Right. That's right. You write about having to overcome a blinding disappointment, I think is your quote, in the field. The field that I, my sense was you see as often enough taking up the position that the neurotic demand for love and knowledge can be met. Can you describe a bit this sort of coming to terms with this blinding disappointment in the field?
It's interesting because when I was the one sort of point that I had stopped at when I was thinking about speaking with you today was the fact that the book hinges on this moment, I think, of blinding disappointment. Yeah. And then I was thinking, and I hadn't thought of this when I had written it, but the play on the word blinding, like both blinding that I can't see, but blinding also in the sort of Oedipal sense, right?
Sure.
Tearing her eyes out.
Sure.
And, you know, it is a question about the end of analysis, right? There's something about disappointment that we have to face up to, or there's something about mourning and death and loss and the sort of falling away of certain ideals or expectations about what we're going to receive, and everything about what we demand from our analysts for a period of time. And I did see the book as sort of turning on what that makes possible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my struggles with the psychoanalytic institution and my struggles with American psychoanalysis and the fragmentation of the field and the fact that, you know, we preach one thing and then we do another when we all get together in our institutional frameworks. Mm-hmm. You know, just to try and say, like, fine, this is what it is. And why should I have expected it to be any other way? That doesn't mean that we can stop asking these questions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think I just desperately wanted to feel like that these questions could be put at the very beginning, that they were always at the beginning and that we can orient ourselves there, that we still have to ask about what it is that we have to know as analysts.
Right.
And that we have to know something about what takes place in the process of going from being an analysand to being a psychoanalyst, that there's something extraordinary that takes place there. And it's not 55 credits, not years in an institute, it's something else.
Right, right. I was thinking about that it seems to me that a lot of American psychoanalysis, and here I'm thinking really about the relational turn. I'm always wondering why does social who cares about social construction? What of hermeneutics? What is making meaning? What are we trying to nail down or to quiet? And what I loved about your book was that it really it turned to the sort of the position of the analyst as the dupe, the analyst as the one who doesn't know. And yet in America, you know, we really like to know things. And I think maybe our analytic training or a lot of it reflects this. I mean, what do you make of the psychoanalyst's work to make meaning?
You know, Lacan disrupted this for me in a way that was so important. And this idea of know yourself and your analyst knows best, or your analyst is the one with the sort of the grip on interpretation. And he questions this from every end. I mean, he literally just questions it outright. But then even the way in which he starts to read Freud, or the way that he starts to work with philosophy, or, you know, it even goes back to just Plato, who sort of never really knows anything. And his sort of questioning stance is what allows this speech to flourish in the other person. You know, Lacan goes back to this. And you cannot read Lacan if you want to know. And right away, you're confronted with that. I mean, I'm sorry for putting you through it with my own book and making you feel stupid, but it's not as if I did not feel stupid for years with Lacan. And you realize that this desire to know, to sort of master meaning, to sort of lock it down, this will never help you go forward.
Right.
And I love that confrontation. It opens up so much the minute that you see the way your own neurosis is pulled into what it means to continue to read him. And exactly what you have to shed in order to sort of move forward. And then this whole world opens up. You know, and he spoke for 28 years in front of an audience just about psychoanalysis. It's an incredible act. And it took a lot of dedication. I can't imagine doing that. Being someone who teaches, it's exhausting, and you want to give the same course so you don't have to do something new, you know, year after year. But he did something new every single year for 28 years.
Right.
And I think that you could only do that if you've managed to sort of push knowledge out of the frame a little bit.
Right. To the side. In fact, I think in my experience of reading Lacan is that I end up completely dumbfounded and sort of have a physical swirling sensation. And I go, I have no idea. And then weeks later, I'm thinking, that did something to me. I mean, I have to say, your book did something to me, which I haven't read something in the field in a while that has given me an experience, which I really I appreciate. I think it's you raise the question in the book about, you know, what's going on with psychoanalytic writing. I think you say something about what the écriture féminin is done, you know, here's the quote, what new reinvigoration of psychoanalysis at this level of the written is still possible? And then you ask, what danger is there in relation to writing that is preventing new forms from developing? And I thought, you know, you've developed a new form here, but do you have any sort of an answer to that kind of a question? I'm asking for some knowledge. What danger is there? What is the danger? I wonder.
I think that there's a lot of security that you can get by hiding behind a kind of writing or a kind of discourse that takes up the sort of mantle of knowledge. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a lot of ways in which you never really expose yourself in that. And I think the danger of inventing something new is the danger of what you're going to show. And, you know, it's a complicated term, but for Lacan, you know, it takes a kind of castration, right? It takes a kind of submission, a subjection, you know, to yourself in order to produce something like this. I mean, this is what your patients do. I mean, they have to experiment with what it means to speak in all kinds of different ways in front of you. And it's terrifying. And, you know, I feel, and maybe this is too much of a demand, I feel like we should mirror what we ask our patients to do in some way in our very own work. Mm-hmm. And that the discordance for me has become so great that it's very hard for me to see myself as an analyst and then to be within this professionalized frame. Like I've really struggled with that disjunction. Mm-hmm. And there were so many, you know, the period that I love so much, which is also there in the dream about La Planche, because my grandmother was specifically alluding to, you know, France in the 1970s. But it was this wonderful moment where everybody started to experiment. you know, that was when these women started writing. They sort of asked what it meant to write as a woman.
Right.
And the philosophers sort of like had deconstructed what it meant to be a philosopher and started, you know, these wild experiments. Like, I'm going to just do a meditation on death.
Right.
And I love this. I think that it's absolutely generative. It's absolutely exciting. You know, we need poetry in our lives. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, there's something about the professionalization of the field that just, it locks all of this down.
Yeah, well, it certainly can. I mean, my training is, you know, as a modern analyst, which listeners to this webcast know, and, you know, moderns, we never leave analysis. The only thing we don't experience is termination. I mean, it's just death. Either the analyst dies or the patient dies, but we really don't, we don't ever end it, and which is interesting because I'm perpetually an analysand, as I am perpetually an analyst. There's never a moment of separation. And, you know, I'll go through periods thinking, well, there's nothing new under the sun going to happen in this analysis. And then suddenly I'm like, oh, my God, more speaking. I don't want to speak. I want to leave. I want to get out of here. I want to run away from this. You know, I mean, this is going to be my life, given my particular kind of training. And I sense for colleagues from other analytic schools, it's like a graduation. And I'm like, what did you graduate from? You know, not just the institute. I'm like, well, but isn't the unconscious like kind of, you know, you can stop. And I understand that maybe I will never experience the end, which is a whole other thing. You know, that the analysis comes to an end, and then what? But you know, what are we graduating from? You know, I don't know. I'm
graduating to.
Yeah, right.
It's even worse.
Exactly. So I was thinking about, I have many quotes I pulled from this book, which I am, which I really love. Like, some will go in the fridge or something to help me finish up my training. But you have a quote that I want to read. Hope what you will, psychoanalysis will remain precarious. We seem to be doing our best to back away from what has always been this precarious place of psychoanalytic truth. Science isn't going to seal up that hole and remove that abyss. Neither will any recourse to folk psychology or Lacanian mathematical formula. And it made me think about those in the field or in the profession who are in love or enamored with neuroscience. I was thinking, what do we say about neuroscience? What would Lacan say, do you imagine, regarding the neuroscientific project as it relates to our work as analysts?
Mm-hmm. It's funny. One of my students at Lang, he's great. Whenever we sort of talk about neuroscience, he says, it's as if you just want to take a golf club to the MRI machines. He's like, am I right about that?
You're like big, and big pharma comes next, you know. Right.
And you know, I think what worries me the most, and this is you know, this is probably a very Lacanian problem, is the fetish of the visual. You know, the idea that we can see something now, you know, and that's going to help us. You know, this is going to solidify the problems of psychoanalysis. I mean, I think that there's great neuroscience out there, and there's really interesting ways of thinking about neuroscience and psychoanalysis, but there's a danger here about the sort of fetish of the visual that worries me, and then also the idea of proof.
Right.
You know, and it's not that, you know, neuroscience hasn't done amazing things for science, but we still have a lot of questions to ask about this boundary between what it is that we do as psychoanalysts with patients in this sort of mad 4 times a week or however many times a week one does it treatment, and what science is there to answer. Mm-hmm. And I worry about the prematurity of sort of running to neuroscience as a savior.
Right.
Particularly because we have to hang on to what this anxiety is about. This anxiety about what it means to be a psychoanalyst. I mean, it really needs to be part of our life. I mean, maybe that's what's great about getting to be an analysand forever. You know, there is no graduation to or from. you know, this anxiety is here to stay, and that's one way to keep it going.
Right. And the moment of, I mean, I've had two analysts die. One was a supervisor for about 14 years and the other was my analyst. And it was like, oh, the awareness that, that they'll die. And then what, you know, well, of course I'm in training. I have to have another analyst and I'm a modern analyst. I have to have another analyst, but it does keep, that anxiety can be very, very generative, but we do our best to kill it. It seems, and there are ways in which maybe the profession does sort of collude with that. Like we can offer something. I know at my institute we're concerned with, you know, what is the question of what is psychoanalytic research? Right. What is psychoanalytic research? I mean, how would you respond to that question? What is it?
I worked as a researcher for many, many years with a friend of mine who actually just passed away, Norbert Friedman, and we had done a number of studies together. It was published in JAPA and in his new book, Another Kind of Evidence. And what was nice about the work that I did with Norbert was he wanted to preserve a space for psychoanalytic knowledge that could be and, you know, should be held as distinct. Mm-hmm. And some of the research we did was always what it meant to sort of locate that border in the work that we were doing. So, you know, you could find a statistical answer about, you know, whatever, some sort of outcome in treatment or some sort of capacity that's developed within the patient. But there's a place where the answer that we're given from it really needs a further explanation. And that further explanation, you know, is just psychoanalytic thinking. Mm-hmm. It's the psychoanalytic thinking that has to go along with it. Even if it's just to define the realm of what we don't understand.
Right.
And I think it's very hard when you're working with numerical systems and statistical systems, which are based on their own logic and their own like desire for predictability, that stands outside whatever this unconscious is or whatever unconscious desire is. You know, Lacan had an idea that there's an opposition here. This is not something that's quantifiable. Subjectivity is something that's not visible or researchable, right? And you have to preserve something of that. I think it's really, really important.
Right. And it's the anxiety that I think that idea produces a lot of anxiety. Well, what is it we're preserving? I can't see it. I can't touch it. I can't taste it. And I think that analysts are lured. You know, there's some impossible anxiety. You know, I thought actually in reading this book, it brought me back to many years ago reading Janet Malcolm's Psychoanalysis: The Impossible Profession. There's something in that book that I think she really does capture the madness that we embrace, that is sort of what we traffic in, what we eventually are immersed. You know, there's an immersion that does take place, and that is ineffable. I mean, I can't note it in myself. I can't find it, but boy, is it ever there. You know, and the discomfort with sort of accepting that. Anyway, I'm not sure that I have a question with that, but it's really great how your book embraces the how much there is that's always unknown and ineffable. You have a really interesting chat. I mean, let's go over the book so people get a better sense of it. I mean, I could sort of say my sense of it, but you write about Adorno and disillusionment with him. Eventually, you write about Lacan, of course, and you write also about Badiou. Mm-hmm. And can you say something about sort of that triumvirate and the place of that triumvirate in your thinking and in your writing in this book?
It's a story of, I think, the thinkers that I was the most involved with, you know, for a period of time. And the idea in the book was, through looking, there's something about what psychoanalysis gave to me, or, you know, whether that's the experience of being in an analyst or what it meant to learn to listen as an analyst and just to approach the questions that psychoanalysis generally raises. in relationship to these thinkers. And it changed something for me, both in relationship to what I want to hear, my relationship to knowledge, how I can sort of locate myself in another person's discourse. Mm-hmm. And Adorno, who I still love very, very much, became a problem for me, which was that he always knew what was wrong.
Oh, yes.
And that's very seductive. Mm-hmm. And it was about the seduction of that position and what that probably did for me at a certain moment in my life, to be on the side of the person who knows what's wrong.
Right.
And you know, to say something about that in the book, that it's a kind of melancholic position and it veers towards a kind of nihilism. And that it holds on to negativity in a way that doesn't really accept what's negative, but uses that negativity to sort of like lash out against the world.
Yes, certainly.
And, you know, Adorno is so important because he is someone who's responding to the traumas of the Holocaust and to trauma in general. Mm-hmm. And it is like the way in which he absorbs it is what's so beautiful about his writing and also so deeply problematic about it. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't want to let that moment happen where you might say, I can get out of this. He's so worried about that. And it was in wrestling with what it might mean to get out of it. And certainly this is also a question, a psychoanalytic question that I was asking myself at that period of time where I needed Lacan. Mm-hmm. I needed Lacan to say, like, you need to take a step out of this. And that the position that you're working in, which is, you know, I'm going to tell you what's wrong with this world.
the moral masochism of that or something, right? Yeah.
And, you know, so the book sort of moves out of talking about Adorno in this way and towards Lacan. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways in which I see that is that Lacan's more feminine discourse, if I wanted to put it like that, opened something up for me. And he has fascinating things to say about women and women's pleasure. And I really appreciate for him the way that he recentered that question, you know, what does woman want? Right. And that, you know, he collapses that, as I say, you know, with a question of otherness, with a question of enigma, with a question of the unconscious in general. And he uses that as a sort of like interpretive mechanism. And it's not something that's not unproblematic. You know, feminists both love this and hated it. Mm-hmm. And there's many things to say about that. But I wanted to sort of put that back at the center, you know, that he had something to say about castration. He had something to say about what women could say. And he sort of taunts them and says, you know, come on, you women analysts, what are you going to do? And, you know, you must know something in particular about the unconscious. I mean, you are in a sort of exclusive position of having been forced to be the object of desire by virtue of, let's just say, socio-historical constraints. Mm-hmm. Tell me about this. Tell me what it's like. And he allowed all these women to write. There's this period where there's just this explosion of women writers. Beautiful.
Absolutely.
Catherine Clément, Michelle Montrelet, Chris Seva. Mm-hmm. And I love that he made that possible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think sort of what I wanted to then do by moving to Badiou, who I think is a really rigorous and interesting theorist, and he sort of takes what he learned from Lacan, and he is a great reader of Lacan, and he just puts it to use all over the place. You know, he looks at art, and he looks at philosophy, and he reads the entire history of philosophy, and he does this crazy math theory, and he starts to work with what Lacan makes possible. And I wanted to both show what he's able to do with that, but also where, once again, I have to fall back on the psychoanalytic discourse. For some reason, despite the fact that Badiou is indebted to Lacan, he will never speak about psychoanalysis.
He doesn't want to. Yeah.
He doesn't want to. He has no interest in this.
Right.
So sort of showing how, you know, at this point I can tease my way out of that relationship. And I, you know, in relationship to this, I will affirm what it means to be a psychoanalyst and what's important about the psychoanalytic discourse.
Yeah. My sense was that he had something to say, or in your encounter with him, that there was something about his relationship to the question of truth, and how you were thinking about psychoanalysis. Is that right? That Badiou has something to say that you found interesting about truth?
Because, you know, he says there's two things that were very important for him in relationship to Lacan. One was that at the moment that Lacan comes onto the scene, you have the sort of beginnings of postmodernism. And postmodernism started to destroy the, or sort of deconstruct or dismantle both the concept of truth and the concept of the subject. Mm-hmm. And for him, what Lacan does is he holds on to both truth and the subject. Mm-hmm. And this was incredibly important. Like, you know, what deconstruction or what postmodern sort of relativism and constructivism brings to the table is important, but this does not mean that we just throw these concepts out.
Right.
And I think that was very important because he does, and I think what's important about it for us is that psychoanalysis also really holds on to these two ideas, that there's a subject and that there's a truth somewhere for that subject. Mm-hmm. You know, and I see psychoanalysis as still sort of stuck on that turning point where we're going to have a more reified idea of truth,
right?
More reified idea of the individual on the one hand, and on the other hand, that we are in danger of sort of, you know, a sort of free for all, anything goes, post-modern relativism, you know, sort of like too much, just like construct your own narrative, you know, which is not how I see the unconscious.
Right. Right, we don't get to quote choose it, and it's sort of a very American idea. I'll make a choice about my unconscious. Really, good luck. you know, you write. You also, I was really taken. I'm thinking a lot about sort of debates regarding trauma, sexual abuse, seduction theory. You know, that seem to be percolating again pretty powerfully. If I'm, you know, I'm always like looking at new texts and, you know, to interview, psychoanalysts here, on the webcast. And I'm amazed by how important trauma is, right now. It seems to be, sort of a really important term, dissociation, trauma, and you write that you're slightly amused, so I felt like we were maybe in tandem here for a moment. You're slightly amused by the fact that we have come back around to the original argument concerning the seduction theory in psychoanalysis. Could you say more about your amusement or your reaction to that?
There's a moment when I was writing about Badiou towards the end, and this question of, you know, what's real and what's not real, what's inside and what's external, the sort of irrevocability of a kind of seduction that's traumatic always, a sexuality that's always traumatic for everybody, but the necessity also of the traumas of our life. I mean, it's not as if there aren't real things that happen to us that have a huge impact, but the definition around that, it could be something very small, which is something that I wrote about when I was talking in the chapter, What Do Women Know? Mm-hmm. You know, about the sort of absence in my life and the way that I sort of found how that structured, mm-hmm. like so many parts of my unfolding story. And, you know, we have to maintain some ambiguity around these questions. You know, we want to sort of rush and say, oh, this was a fantasy. Or we want to rush and say, no, it was a trauma.
Right.
And, you know, psychoanalysis has to preserve these places as sites of contestation.
Right.
You know, our patients have to ask this question, and we have to not rush to answer it and see, in fact, what answers they come to.
Right. Right.
What's true about it for them.
Right. To not let something collapse, to maintain the tension that's necessary to pursue, to help the patient to say more, the analysis, and to always say more. Yeah, I was struck. I the other night I went to hear Jameson speak at the New York Psychoanalytic Institute on it was a really fascinating talk on Hamlet and on desire, and at the end of sort of our time, an analyst, I presume, in the room was asked a question. I don't know. He said something about problem, you know, with psychoanalysis today, like what might cause its death, I guess, so to speak, was that it lacked it's the move that if we don't embrace what's interpersonal, we're really at risk of sort of ruining or killing psychoanalysis, which I was taken aback by. I wondered, I maybe think that the interpersonal runs, too much interpersonal runs the risk of ruining psychoanalysis. But I wanted to hear your thoughts about that, that kind of a tension between the intrapsychic and the interpersonal on the American scene. And you have thoughts about that?
I do. I mean, it's something that I've struggled with because having sort of been brought up on Freud through Lacan, it makes it difficult to understand the ways in which these polarities have played out here. So, I mean, I feel like I'm of a generation where I understand where the relational and the interpersonal movements have been a reaction to a kind of more classical framework and what they felt that left out. But it's not the way that I was taught to read Freud. And Lacan is very subtle on this interplay. I mean, if you look at the mirror stage, it's this incredible unfolding dialectic between the intrapsychic and the interpersonal. Mm-hmm. Right? And the question of desire itself is not unconditioned by the outside world, although it remains something that's constructed internally in a way that we have no power over. Mm-hmm. Right, and how we find our way with our desire in the Lacanian sense is never going to be something that's just an intrapsychic piece of work. I mean, his idea, in which I sort of try and push throughout the book, is that we have to make something of our desire in the world. This is the hinge of our connection to the world and to others. And so I find it so hard, these arguments, where, you know, everyone is angry at each other for having something out. And sort of I'm like, I don't have this problem.
Right.
I don't want this argument, this political argument about this. I want to talk about psychoanalysis. And I see this in my students too, who feel sort of bewildered by the American scene.
Yeah. You know,
and it feels like arguments that are old.
Mm-hmm.
And that we shouldn't leave out what the stakes of them were.
Right.
We should have a way of moving forward.
Right. Yeah, because it seems to be like, well, does the analyst really exist in America? The analyst has needs in America. And it's very, it seems to me so a very American position. You know, the fantasy of transparency, of revealing the counter transference, democracy. These are questions that, I mean, you get the sense, you know, from Lacan, like democracy.
Right.
What does democracy have to do with psychoanalysis?
Right.
Freedom is one thing, but democracy is another, right?
And democracy, you know, I love the way in which he'll push this question. I'll say, he'll say, democracy now? Like, what, you think that we've achieved democracy?
Right, is this what we're going for?
Right. Is this anything that you think that you possess that then you can then hand over to another person? I mean, what kind of a fantasy is that?
It's a powerful one that does away with anxiety, right? You have a really wonderful description, I think, of the position occupied by the analyst, and it is a very feminine position as you describe it, and it seems to hinge on a relationship with sort of the sexual, the body. I think you term it shame, decency, modesty, humility, prudence, which seems it spoke to me as being at the heart of my stance. If on a good day, could you? I don't know what I want. I just want to hear you talk more about that. I really was moved by that description.
I remember a former supervisor of mine has been very important to. Me and my formation, and we would have long discussions about the masochism of the analyst.
Mm.
And, you know, what about this is feminine, or what does Lacan mean if he's going to collapse the feminine with castration, with masochism, with submission, with subjection? You know, like, what does it mean to sort of load all of this onto the side of the analyst? And to feel these not as belabored terms, but to talk about it in terms of what it is that we have to take. And it is so much about a kind of impossible passivity, an impossible subjection to the discourse of a patient. You know, you just have to give yourself over to them, and you have to give yourself over to contingency. I know that people would be very upset by the idea of collapsing that with something so gendered as to say that it's feminine, but that made something possible for me interpretively. Mm-hmm. And, it's in opposition, I think, to what Lacan construes as the problems of the phallus.
Right.
Right. And that if there's anything that we should have worked through, it's the fantasy about the phallus.
Right. Yeah, first and foremost, right?
First and foremost.
Yeah, right. The temptation, I think you, someplace, let me see if I can find the quote here, right, about the kind of closure, the fantasy of closure, and sort of getting rid of anything that's tenuous. And it seems that the position of the analyst, as you describe it, is there is a caution in a way that I provides room and space. But you're right. We are having to take or absorb a tremendous amount. You know, you have in the book. You write about passion, courage, fidelity, fatigue, and weariness. And these are, and I think that's right. That there's a fatigue and a weariness that comes from being an analyst from not knowing. It can be very exhausting. But I appreciate. That's your approach. And I guess from there, I was thinking about, you have a section on borderlines, which really jumped out at me. It actually jumped out at me. I thought, what is this doing here? What's going on? You know, and you have an outtake from a Kernberg session. And I thought that, I wondered about the way in which, I don't know if that was Kernberg himself or somebody he supervised, that I thought that analyst must be pretty tired at the end. But can you say something about this fantasy of getting the patient to sign a contract, to take responsibility? What? How does this work within analysis? I mean, what's going on with this?
It struck me that You do feel sympathy for the analyst.
Oh my God.
But I also, like, I love this patient who's just like, she's you know, she's sticking it to him.
Right.
And every contradiction, she's gonna sort of pull the contradiction of his sort of failing to hold the analytic position out of him. Mm-hmm. She's gonna make it visible. And it was about that interplay between these two people and the idea that you can't force responsibility. I mean, we all know how difficult it is to take responsibility. And this is also implicit in the idea of prudence, the prudence and modesty of the analyst. What kind of responsibility do we take as psychoanalysts? I know it's a difficult, I mean, in that case vignette, just for your listeners, it's a patient who sort of, they have to contract for safety because of a suicide attempt. And, you know, the technical questions of this, I sort of push aside, but I want to talk about the fact that we are immediately always put into the position of talking about what it means to take responsibility. Mm-hmm. And we know that analytically, this is what we have to work towards. So the idea that you could put this up front.
Right. Beginning with responsibility. It's like, really?
Yeah.
Me now? Right. How could I?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really, but it did jump out at me because I was thinking about the relationship, of course, between, you know, the but, you know, thinking back to, I forget, was it Alain Cixous who had this essay that had I remember it had sort of a frame of shoes around it. This is way back in the 70s. It was a French women's shoes and American women's shoes. They were sort of like lace-ups and pumps, you know, or something. And then I was thinking about what's the relationship, you know, between the hysteric and the borderline, which I think you were sort of, you know, because you are writing, you are sort of between two worlds, the French and the American. and the encounter with the borderline, as opposed to the hysteric, I found myself wanting to be more hysterical than borderline, certainly, in the reading of this. But do you have thoughts about sort of the, I don't know, those two, we don't really talk about hysteria much outside of the Lacanian scene here in American psychoanalysys. Is that your impression?
It is my impression, although, you know, of course, sort of what I pitch is that when we're talking about the borderlines, we're talking about hysterics.
Yep.
And what's interesting about it is not so much diagnosing them or defining them, but showing how they sort of tell you about what the analytic position needs to be. Mm-hmm. And they're constantly showing us where it is. Because I think that for Lacan, what was so fundamental about thinking about hysteria is that it's at the beginning of our profession. I mean, psychoanalysis comes to us through them, through what they came to say. I mean, it's Anna Oh who named it the talking cure.
Right.
And they will tell you when you become phallic, if you want to put it that way. They will tell you when you've left the analytic position. They will tell you when you failed to hear their desire and instead you've tried to suture what they've said. You've tried to close it down. And the Lacanians are the only ones who I know of. I mean, I'm sure you could find it in many other places. I wouldn't want to say that they're the only ones, but I found in their discourse this way of saying, you know, it is through them that we will learn who we have to be and how to listen. Mm-hmm. And I love that. It sort of takes it out of your hands and puts it into the patient. Mm-hmm. And, you know, also recenters, I think, your work as an analysand. Now, Lacan does not stop at hysteria. He says, you know, we have to understand what it means then to analyze the hysteric. It'll tell us about this slight shift between what he calls the discourse of the hysteric and the discourse of the analyst. Mm-hmm. And for him, what's the travesty is that they get caught up in their wound, if you want to put it that way. They get caught up in their castration. Mm-hmm. And they want to believe that it can be made better. They want to believe that there is an impossibility. They want to believe that the sexual relation is possible, if you want to put it that way. Mm-hmm. And we help them see. We help them see the way in which this is an impossibility. Their desire is structured in relationship to these impossibilities, the constraints of their history, the constraints of the times in which they live. But that there's something very beautiful about their wishes and they can make a life around them.
Right.
And, you know, more than anywhere, we do this through dreams, I think, where we see this sort of fascinating interplay of wish and impossibility, always. You know, what you want in your dreams or what you come to see about what you want in your dreams, you know, then sort of smashes up against reality when the moment you wake up.
That's right. It's a lot. It's a huge effort to wake up sometimes. Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything that we haven't touched on about the book that you wanted to say, or any? Because we're coming. Oh, we're at 50 minutes and 26 seconds. It says here, so we're it's fine that we go over. But is there anything that we didn't get to that you wanted to convey? You know, or say?
No, I guess the only thing that I maybe would add is, you know, the book is about desire. The sort of subtitle that's hidden, which I sort of asked to do by my publisher, is On Unconscious Desire and Its Sublimation. And I think I really did want to bring these two words back to the table, desire and sublimation. And I think that they're very important words. And the thing that I love the most about being an analyst is, I think, seeing how deep desire runs. And then when you see the solutions that a patient makes for their life, whether it's in who they choose to love, how they choose to love them, or, you know, their fascinating work lives, it's just so bound up with this desire that's always already there. And you don't have to then give them anything. You don't have to tell them anything. You don't have to make anything mean anything. And that's such a relief, you know, for all of the fatigue that I'm talking about of what it means to be an analyst. This is a real relief. And it's a relief that I found in asking or seeing psychoanalysis through Lacan, and you know, it's what I wanted to convey in the book.
And I think you convey it very well, but it is sort of interesting. It is a hidden subtitle. In fact, I read through the whole book and somehow missed that page, and then I was somehow looking around and I said, wait a minute, here's this subtitle. I said, yeah, that's right. That's what it. That's what the book is turned toward and addressing itself to. Okay, we're out of time, and I just wanted to say thank you very, very much for spending time with us at New Books in Psychoanalysis, and have a feeling we'll be following you and following your career, because I would guess that there's going to be a lot more that you're going to have to say, which I look forward to reading. And so thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.